Welcome to a new episode of Geeks at Large. I'm your host, Taylor, and I'm joined by...
What?
That's Neil, everybody. And
hi,
neither
everybody.
Of us are wearing pants.
That is an actual factual statement. That is...
Yep. Yeah. But unlike the subject of making a murderer, Stephen Avery, we do own underwear. How's that for a segue?
Well, you... Yeah, I mean, I was going to go somewhere similar to that, where I was just like, you don't need forensic evidence to know that we're not wearing pants. And then you just took that an entirely different route, so.
Yep. But.
Give yourself.
You probably noticed by the title of this episode, which I have not yet come up with, but I'm sure it's going to tell you about the fact that we're going to discuss true crime documentaries. Before we get into that. I do want to catch up with Neil, because we haven't talked to him since, what, like, Star Wars?
Those are my favorite kind of crimes.
The true ones?
Oh my god, you're right. Yeah, that's been about 2 months. Yeah.
Yep. So how you been, Neil?
Funny enough, a lot of stuff is, like, okay, not a whole lot has happened, but the stuff that has happened has been pretty big.
Uh-huh. Go on.
So that's pretty... So I was working on a short documentary for a while there. I think I might have talked about it on air a little bit.
I don't think you did.
Really? Okay. It's called Geriatric One Comics Climb 77 Year Climb to the Top of the Bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a local Atlanta comedian, Jerry Farber, who's basically like a staple of Atlanta culture. He's been around since a long, long time. And he's had multiple clubs and, he's very big in the stand-up circuit in Atlanta. And, a good friend of mine, Leanna Adams and I, she was the director. She approached me about the project back in 2014 and asked me like, hey, would you like to help work on this? And I was like, yeah, sure. If you're serious with it. Well, that's what...
Pay me money, yes, please.
Press kit says. Well, there's like no money in it, but it's been a good experience. In the press kit and everything, whenever they talk about it, it's like, you know, she says that she had brought it up with me, and I had said, you know, if you're really serious about this, I'll work on this with you. But in actuality, what happened was she said, hey, you want to work on this? And I said, yes, I need work. Please give me anything. So it was that kind of time.
Vegas can't be Jesus, baby.
Well, this turned out to be a pretty good one anyway. So no complaints here. It's done quite well, actually. It premiered at the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival a couple weeks ago, and it was in two blocks, and it was the first film shown in each block. And they actually had Leanna and Jerry talk right before the film started. So that's pretty nice. Like that's a big deal.
It's a pretty small crew too. It's like basically the three of you, isn't it? Or is there,
yeah, that was, yeah. So there were a couple other camera people, for different things. I was the head cinematographer, but there was a group of two people who filmed an interview with Jerry. That's very prominent. That's, featured very prominently throughout the documentary. And they were just people that Leanna had worked with on a film, and they just happened to have some leftover equipment. And then she was like, hey, you want to film an interview? So they did. And then they're just off doing their own thing, I think. I don't know too much about them. And then there were two other guys. One guy who actually was like a grip on the set of the new Captain America movie. He had a Blackmagic camera. And
Ooh. Yeah,
those things are nice, actually. They're really nice. And he went and filmed some B-roll with Leanna. And then there was this other guy who shot like one thing for us. But I was the lead cinematographer. I filmed probably the most stuff that's in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the editor. And
nice.
So all the editing, that was me on my laptop.
And I did read an article that named you. So that's cool.
Oh, did you? Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Did you?
It said Neil Butler. It said Neil Butler. Well, because I think I saw you were tagged in what's your friend's name that was the director?
Oh, Leanna yeah. Adams.
I think she posted an article or something about it.
Okay.
And I think that's where I saw it. And I think there's like it's got a couple pictures. Like it's got like one picture of like you two, I think, or like the yeah. three of you. Yeah.
Okay.
And you get and like I wanted to make sure that you got name dropped. And like I searched your name and I found it. I'm like, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, they actually mentioned me, and it was so nice. And mm-hmm. like it was literally just dropping my name in like an anecdote, and that was about it. But
well, yeah, because it was like editor and cinematographer Neil Butler, and it's like, oh, there you go.
There you go, Ma. I made it.
Look, Ma, no hands. I'm on top of the world.
Yeah, it's gotten a few reviews, and they've all been, like, glowing, so that's been really nice.
Fuck yeah, dude.
And I put a lot of, I mean, like, Leanna obviously put a lot of work into it, but, like, I put so much work into that thing, so it's really, because, like, I was doing, like, the bulk of the editing, and I would just send it over to Leanna, and Leanna's like, do this, do this, do this. I'm like, okay, great. But, like, you know, most of the editing, that's me. So. Yes.
Well, and documentaries are, wouldn't you say, arguably is like some of the hardest stuff to edit?
It really is. It really is.
Because you're not only just like telling story information, like in a regular movie, you're telling like factual information, you know, like in something from, I don't know, a Morgan Spurlock movie or a Werner Herzog documentary. It's like you're telling information, you're presenting points, you have a thesis, you know?
Well, it's not correct. Just that, but with document, I mean, like with films, obviously, you know, you've got the script and everything. You're running based on that script. With documentaries, you have to craft the story using what you have. And sometimes just finding, like, whittling down enough to where you start to say, like, oh, this is the order it should start going in, or like, oh, this is what I want to tell now that I've got all this stuff. That's like some of the hardest stuff to do. It really is. So with this one, it was crazy because like we were finding new sources to put in this documentary as it went along.
And this is a like, short documentary too. This is like what, like 30 minutes or something?
Oh no, it's 18 minutes.
Damn.
We wanted it to be 15, but we just couldn't keep cutting anymore. Like I think eventually I had to put my foot down and say like, Leanna, we can't keep adding stuff in, we have to start subtracting. And then after a while, I think both of us are just like, we have finally hit the maximum level of things that we can cut until we have to start rearranging some things seriously. Because all of a sudden, like if you cut any more, you might as well just lose that entire bit. So yeah, 18 minutes, seven, I think it's like 17 and a half in actuality. They just rounded up to 18. That was the most we could do. And we're very proud of it.
Are you going to enter it in any, like, festivals? Any more festivals, I should say? Is there any way?
We're sending it out to a whole bunch of... Well, okay, Leanna is sending them out to a whole bunch of places. I'm just like, you know what, hon, you do that.
Well, it is her thing. She's the director, you know? It's that's her responsibility. Like,
I have no reason to be doing it. Like, it's not my place to do it. She's the one who is doing all that stuff, and I'm very happy she's doing it.
Is there any place that they could... Anyone like listeners could view it yet, or is that still?
It's not open for public viewing yet. It is on the internet, but you need a password. And I think until I would have to run it by the I would have to run it by Leanna, the director, to see what she thinks about when we would be able to open it up to public viewing. But do you know
what you would do? Would you put it on like Vimeo or something like that?
It's on Vimeo. It's on Vimeo.
Oh.
It's just password protected.
Okay, so we can't publicly post it here yet.
You can't publicly post it. I can, however, give you the trailer that I cut together that we had to cut together to submit to festivals. I'll happily send you the link to the trailer. And yeah, that's what I've been working on. But
yeah, because we got Sweet Weenie going on too.
Yeah, Sweet Weenie's going on too.
And for those, tell the people that don't know what Sweet Weenie is, what it is.
Sweet Weenie is a YouTube channel that's run by my best friend Will's girlfriend Andy, Andy Sager. She runs a webcomic on a website called SweetWeenie.com. And she came to us a while ago. It's run by her, me, and Steven and Ryan, you know, the other members of Geeks
at Large. Yeah, other members of Geeks at Large. Steven's been on. He was on. The last episode he was on was the summer films one. It's been a while.
Ryan
hasn't been on any since Geeks at College was a thing.
Yeah.
He's a busy guy, though. He's a busy guy. He's actually making money, unlike most of us.
Well, he now finally has a job in his field.
Oh, yeah, he does.
Yeah, yeah. So I should have him on to talk about that. What's that?
I should have him on to talk about that.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
But anyways, so it's you, Steven, Ryan, Andy, and Will.
Will. Yeah, Will contributes. Will has his own YouTube channel though that he maintains. So like, I want to put him in more things because like he just shows up to filming sessions and it's just like I don't know what to do. It's like I feel so bad.
Yeah, because he's known on YouTube as Bobo Lolo, right?
Yeah,
yeah. And he does Nerf mods and stuff like that. So
he's doing incredibly well there. So I mean, no complaints. Hell, he's been helping us out a lot with advertising and whatnot. Considering it is his girlfriend's page. So yeah. He's been really helpful about that. Like if you ever go to his YouTube channel, which is I am Bobo Lolo, that's the URL.
Yeah, it's Bobo Lolo. If you Google it should come up. Yeah.
Yep. But on the recommended channels at the bottom, like Sweet Winnie's the first one. So that's really cool. I think we have like 30 subscribers, which is nice considering that we haven't really been doing a whole lot of advertising. You know, that's pretty cool. It seems to have risen even more since we stopped posting things.
Yeah, but I think like, once you start getting stuff and you'll get kind of connected to other,
get
stuff going.
Maybe we'll have a breakout video. Maybe we'll have that one that people are like, oh my gosh. We haven't posted anything for a few months, not because of we just don't want to do it anymore. We're still very much so doing it. It's just everyone's schedules haven't lined up a lot. Like we stopped doing it around end of December, like mid to end of December. And since then, you know, it's just everyone's gone back to work. Things have gotten really busy. So it is still just a hobby. Like it's
a hobby. You have it like you monetized it, but
yeah, we monetized our videos, but really we only monetized it so that I could gain access to scheduled uploading, which makes my life so much easier.
Exactly.
That's the only reason we did it.
And I'll link it. I mean, I've linked, I think the last couple episodes, but it's Sweet Weenie. Spelled like you would spell those two words, one word though.
It is exactly how it sounds.
S W E E T W E E N I E, Sweet Weenie. And be sure to subscribe, like, comment, and subscribe. We've totally sold out.
Like a call to action for ours. I think we even had a conversation about it. It's like, yeah, we should start putting some stuff at the end of videos, but we hate that stuff.
Well, but it works. I mean,
it works. No, we're just amused. Like we're having to constantly talk about like, oh, we need to expand or like do these things that other people do. Like, yeah, but that shit sucks. Like, yeah, we know.
Well, it's like you gotta be like you know how the Game Grumps do ads for like Crunchyroll and shit. You gotta take something that sucks and make it into something great.
Yeah, I know. you know? Well, we're trying to figure out how we can get away, like how we can do it in our own way. With that, like in a way that we could do it and not like hate ourselves afterwards, if that makes sense.
I mean, make it like almost like a weird self-aware joke kind of thing.
Yeah, that's kind of we had kind of discussed it a little bit, but we hadn't talked about it too much.
Like, I feel like you could have Ryan do some kind of improv or something, and that'd be fun.
Probably.
But anyway, yes.
Yeah.
Sweet Weenie, and. So you got Sweet Weenie and you got Geriatric. I'll link the trailer for Geriatric and the page for Sweet Weenie. And the problem is that now we're like the links that I'm putting at the bottom of every post, it's like becoming longer because we also have audio commentaries that we're selling.
That's right.
They're free to stream from Bandcamp. That's where
we prefer if you purchase them.
Well, I mean, hey, if It'd be cool if you could, if you wanted to, you know, they're a buck each. Or if you want to pay more, you can pay more.
I certainly
don't know why you'd pay more though.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, I like being able to afford things, and you know, that happens when people buy things. So
buy our things. And I'm gonna advertise it now so I don't forget at the end of the video of the podcast. But
okay.
Yeah, so we got commentaries of Die Another Day, Die Hard, and Attack of the Clones. So if either of those, any of those movies, you know, tickle your fancy, then please give them a listen. And if you like what you hear, hey, buy it. You know, maybe please.
please buy.
Don't sound too desperate.
Don't sound too desperate, but I'd suck some dicks. Just please buy them.
Okay, and I guess we'll wrap this up. I'll talk about what I've been doing.
Yes.
A lot of it's just been working on, still working on art. I've probably mentioned I'm working on a pitch packet with some friends from SCED. That's pretty much completed now, and we're kind of getting feedback from people, reaching out. It's part of the whole comic process. It's not the best part of the process, because you want to just kind of draw and make art, but you know, it has to happen.
It's the marketing aspect of it, which I hate.
And we're aiming at two publishers. One's called Action Lab and one's called Z2 Comics, and they're both independent publishers, but as a writer in the industry told me that I was fortunate enough to have a phone conversation with, is that you kind of want to work with those people, because since they're so small, they don't have a lot, you know, so they kind of advertise everything.
Yeah.
You know, because I mentioned like Image to him, and he told me like, you know, Image is so big now that they really only advertise like their big, big series, like The Walking Dead or Saga or Invincible, stuff like that. Versus, because there's like a shit ton of Image comics, and some that you probably don't even know are Image comics. But I'll tell you what, I follow Action Lab on Twitter, and they advertise everything. So, so that's always a plus.
Yay.
And I remember mentioning last year I was part of a Kickstarter for a Mad Max Fury Road fanzine that was a successful campaign. So if any of you listeners contributed to it, thank you. Any additional proceeds went to a women's shelter. I don't know if they've chosen which one yet, but obviously they want to make sure it's a, well, I mean, yeah, okay. Give a dollar to all 1,000 of them, you know, it's like, or something like that. But no, I mean, it was really cool. I saw at least one of my friends on Facebook, one of my personal friends, contributed and got a copy of it. So it's cool to see your stuff printed.
Oh, yeah.
And I also lastly, I should say, I am going to be in Chicago around St. Patrick's Day for C2E2, which is their comic book expo there. And
you're going to be in Chicago?
I may be in Chicago for
St. Patrick's Day.
Well, no, to go to a con around St. Patrick's Day.
You gonna drink the green beer? Not that's been dyed, but the ones that's so old that it's infected with something?
Probably.
You gonna die from drinking
it? I'm gonna get the consumption.
Yay, just like our forefathers.
Beautiful. But no, like, I fly it's in on St. Patrick's Day. The con's actually like the 18th through the 20th. But there's going to be a lot of cool people there. There's going to be actors, there's going to be comic artists and all kinds of shit. So I'm excited. And maybe, cause I'm going to be staying with, my friend Cam, who's also, I'm working on the pitch packet with, since he lives in Chicago. And so I don't have to pay for a hotel, which is nice. And we'll probably do some kind of show around that. So look forward to that in March. But yeah, I think that about does it for our updates, right?
Hotel prices suck. I mean, yes, that's about it.
That's about it. So now we can get to the main course, which, as I mentioned in the beginning, is true crime documentaries, which, of course, as you probably have guessed by my early reference, or just the fact that you've been on the internet, is that there's kind of been this huge new wave of interest in true crime documentaries, whether it's stuff like, well, I mean, I say documentaries, but we also want to lump in Serial, because it's a balanced breakfast. And
yeah.
I made a funny. No, I'm talking about.
Shut up.
Okay. No, I'm talking about the Serial podcast by Sarah Koenig, spinoff from This American Life, and we'll lump that in too because it's a big part of it too. It's an audio. It's almost like an audio documentary, if that makes any fucking sense.
It really is. Okay, so which one came first in terms of like really sparking the zeitgeist? I mean, like obviously Serial came first before Making a Murderer did, but which one do you say sparked something bigger? Would it be Serial or Making a Murderer?
I would say Serial because that first season was huge.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I mean, isn't it the first podcast or whatever to reach like 5 million downloads?
Yeah, it is to this day the biggest podcast, the most downloaded podcast of all time.
Yeah, and I would also lump in, and we'll talk about this more when we get to like near the end with our recommendations and stuff, but Jinx.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
The Robert Durst documentary, because that came before Making a Murderer too. And really, Serial and the Jinx are the two things that Making a Murderer have been compared to. They're like, this is Netflix's answer to that.
Yeah, exactly. It was weird because I remember when you brought up this pitch for me, I initially thought, man, are we going to talk about the Jinx? I really want to talk about the Jinx. But then it's like, well, the Jinx, everything that needs to be said about the Jinx has already been said. Like even at the end of, like, with the end of the Jinx ended. Like, yeah. there's still stuff. I mean, there's still some stuff going on there, but they still got Robert Durst. You know, they apprehended him.
Spoilers.
Oh, sorry. Unless, well, I'm sorry, I mean, if you don't ever read a newspaper or anything.
What's a newspaper?
Yeah, I just, as soon as that left my mouth, I was like, wait, Neil, nobody buys newspapers anymore.
Is that made of paper?
Joke is dumb. I'm sorry if you ever haven't gone on the internet yet, which, let's be honest, how are you listening to this?
Well, I mean, should we talk about more about Serial, or should we talk about Making a Murderer?
Can't we do both?
¿Por qué no las dos?
Okay, so I literally saw someone talking about how someone, some white guy, should not be speaking Spanish because they are not Spanish.
Neil, why do you bring this up?
Because you were speaking.
I don't fucking care. I have great respect for the Hispanic people.
I just saw that and I was like, oh my god, we're reaching peak stupidity here.
But that's such a great quote, that adorable little girl, ¿por qué no las dos?
I know.
I guess we should focus mostly. I would say we should focus mostly on Making a Murderer, because I think that's a bigger. It's more people have know what that is and have experienced it.
Yeah, you could say that, like with Serial, you know, like something actually came out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Making a Murderer is still kind of in the doldrums of
Well, because it's also more recent. It's only 2 months old.
Oh my god, it feels like an eternity.
It feels like fucking forever, but I mean, Serial's been...
All the pieces I've been subjected to about it, man, it sure feels like an eternity.
Yeah, it does. But anyway, let's talk about Making a Murderer.
Everyone and their moms has an opinion about Making a Murderer and Stephen Avery.
Do you wanna inform those that don't know what Making a Murderer is?
Okay, Making a Murderer is a Netflix documentary. That's how many episodes is it? Like 14?
13?
13.
10 or something.
13,
like
14. It feels like 50. So
it feels super long, which in this case is might not be a bad thing, but
it feels punishing in its length. But that's kind of the point. It's yeah. not like because of poor editing or anything. Like, it just feels like an eternity.
It's
spent
10 episodes.
In hell.
It's 10 episodes.
So. Oh, you're kidding me. It felt
yeah,
like,
but it feels like 14. But in an appropriate way.
Yeah.
Because it feels this like because it's like
this is one of the few things that I would ever say, like the runtime, like it's really punishing runtime actually works to its favor.
Yeah, because each episode is like at least an hour.
Yeah.
It's like an HBO show. Unlike
it is very slowly, deliberately paced, but man, does that really work to its advantage?
Mm-hmm. Yep,
because it's just a soul destroying experience. So, okay, Making a Murderer is a Netflix documentary series about a man in Manitowoc County. Is it Wisconsin?
Yes, it's Wisconsin. It's close. It's pretty close to Green Bay.
It explains all those fucking terrible accents. Man named Stephen Avery, who did 18 years in prison for a sexual assault that he did not commit.
Yes, and he was exonerated.
He was exonerated from because they had DNA evidence that it was some other guy. So anyways, they release him from prison. And then how long is it after he's released does he go back or that he is apprehended for the supposed – for allegedly murdering this woman whose car and remains were found on his property?
Yeah, he was accused and arrested for murdering Teresa Halbach.
Yeah,
in 2005, and then
she was convicted. A freelance photographer.
Well, she—I don't even know if she was freelance. I know maybe she was, but she worked for. She was working with like, was it Enterprise or something? She was photographing cars.
Was it Auto Trade?
Or maybe I don't know something like that.
It was a car magazine, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's why she, because the whole thing is that Stephen Avery and his family own a junkyard, like a scrapyard.
Yeah,
for cars and such, and so she went there to photograph cars, and that's like the whole connection there, and so it's basically 2 years after he was exonerated, this whole other thing comes in, and basically you get the first episode, and the first episode is all about that first 18 years where he was in prison, and then you go through the whole process, you learn about his early life. How he was kind of a weird kid. He wasn't, the smartest kid or the most straight and narrow kid. But then, you go through the whole thing about him being arrested for the sexual assault and attempted murder of this woman named Penny Bernstein or Bernstein, something like that.
I think so.
And And then once they're cleared that, then it's like, the gloves come off and then you get into the rest of the show.
Yeah. That's just one episode. Jesus.
Yeah. And you're just like, oh fuck. And his family gets brought into it, including his nephew. And that's a whole other thing. And then, it's just, I guess we should just say, do you want to do like kind of a spoilery discussion? We'll put like a spoiler warning.
Yeah, you're going to have a spoiler warning.
If you haven't watched all of Making a Murderer yet, we're going to say spoilers right now. Spoiler warning. And I'll include a timestamp for when you can skip to.
It'll just be like the literally the end time of the episode.
Yes, it'll be like 6 hours.
Yeah.
A timestamp that doesn't exist.
Like any other time, I'd be totally fine with doing like a spoiler-free review of anything. But Making a Murderer is really hard to talk about without inevitably spoiling it. Like, I mean, like first of all, it was real life. Like this actually happened. You can look it up on Wikipedia if you wanted to. But why would you deprive yourself of watching Making a Murderer on Netflix?
Because that's another fascinating aspect of it is that it's kind of like, and this is same with Serial 2, is that they're both like. Not cold cases, but they're old cases.
Yeah.
Like you have
just separated by a letter.
Exactly. But it's like, how many people remember what's the name of the guy from Serial that was convicted? Adnan Syed.
Sorry, I thought you were talking about season 2. It was like Bo Bergdahl.
No. We'll touch a bit on that season. I know you haven't seen it, so I won't spoil much.
I have not.
So, but like, that's the thing. Like, I mean, I think I remember hearing little bits, or I might have watched like an episode of 48 Hours.
Yeah.
About the murder of that girl, whose name also escapes me. What's it?
Haman Lee.
Yeah, Haman Lee. That's what it is.
Yeah.
So Haman Lee's murder. It's like I remember. I mean, we were in grade school when it happened.
Yeah.
So
it was 1999, wasn't it?
It was the end of 99.
Yeah.
When it happened. And I like how it just kind of stirs back up and it's like, oh, now you can like look at it in retrospect kind of thing. Like,
yeah,
there's a part of me that almost wants someone to do that about, I almost want like a serial about fucking Scott Peterson's trial or some shit.
Oh my God, that'd be fascinating.
It'd be fucking awesome. I don't think it'll happen because you probably need the cooperation of Scott Peterson.
But whatever happened to Scott Peterson? Like, did he
get shanked? He's on death row.
Is he?
Yeah, he's still on death row, dude. It's California.
Okay. I didn't know if he'd gotten shanked in prison yet or not.
I don't know. I think you might have more protection in death row.
Yeah, probably.
Because they would kill you themselves. Yeah. But going back to my point first is like I like how it's like because I remember hearing about this vaguely. Like I think I remember hearing stuff about Stephen Avery in Wisconsin because my mom would watch this stuff. She actually would watch like the trials happening. I remember watching the Scott Peterson trial. And it was fascinating watching the Michael Jackson trial before he died, stuff like that. And I think I remember hearing about this and, you know, but then I forgot about it. And then you hear it again. It's like, oh shit, that's right. And then you just kind of, and Mikey Murr just blows the whole thing up and you just kind of learn all this shit and just, you know, it's really fascinating and engrossing. And to
it's
your point
really
about how it,
depth.
Yes, it's very, yeah,
it is like punishingly in depth
because it's like filmed over 10 years. So suck it, Boyhood. This is better than you.
Well, no, Boyhood was 12 years. So
I know, but fuck it. No one fucking cares about Boyhood anymore.
That's true. That's kind of sad, but yeah, it's kind of true. Like nobody really talks about Boyhood anymore.
I think people just realized that Boyhood was just kind of a gimmick.
Yeah, it was good, but not great.
Where it's like, oh, like, well, because the whole advertising was, imagine if Making a Murderer's advertising was like, filmed over 10 years, like, whatever.
Make a Murderer, it took 10 years to make.
Like that's like the subtitle
yeah.
of the show.
Boyhood, it took 12 years to make. One of the more overused jokes over on Red Letter Media, but goddamn if I don't still love it.
But it's so true, that's why it's funny.
It is. It very much so is. Well, I think even the Red Letter Media guys are kind of distancing themselves away from it. I think it's just the subreddit that keeps it alive.
Well, now you have the Revenant.
They filmed it when it was cold.
It was cold.
Yes.
But to your point about Making a Murderer and how it's like it's 10 episodes, but it feels like 20 or whatever.
Yes.
You know, I think part of it is just. Every episode kind of drops this new bomb, you know, it's like just drops this new fact or some shit. And it's like, it's really interesting how they take this true life thing and somehow make it like this serialized fictional drama in that there's all these twists that you don't see coming, even though it's like, again, like you said, you can just research it if you really
You could literally look it up on Wikipedia and have the entire thing spoiled for you.
Yeah, but that's boring.
It is. Why would you do that to yourself?
So what do you think give me like your top three big, like, you know, huge revelations in Making a Murderer?
I think still the ones that they really didn't go into as much as I would have liked. One of them would be the cop who came across Teresa Halbach's green Toyota RAV4.
It's like Colburn or something.
Yeah, it's like Sergeant Colburn or something.
Yeah,
Officer Colburn. And manages to have like all of this information that no one should have.
Exactly.
And he shouldn't have, and yet he just has it. Like I really think that if the defense had really played that up more, they could have had something.
Because what happens was it's like so Teresa Halbach goes missing, and there's this huge manhunt. And of course, it's pretty much, you know, the fingers pointing at Stephen Avery and his family because she was last seen there taking pictures of their cars. And the shoe kind of drops. The shoe finally drops when they find her. I think it's a RAV4.
Yeah,
is her car. They find it, you know, near the back of the lot. Because they have like 1,000 cars or some shit. Like
it, yeah, it
or even thousands of cars. And so suddenly the spotlight really falls on Stephen Avery because they find the car in the car lot. And they're like, well, how else can this be here? But to your point, as you mentioned, this Colburn guy already knows like the license plate and all this shit about it. The fact that a woman who's in the search party finds the car within like 30 minutes of the search starting.
Yeah.
Like she knows where to find it.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of stuff. And I think, Man, that Colburn guy is such a fucking weasel. Like,
okay, is he as bad as the prosecuting attorney though?
No, but I mean, come on, that's like, you know, look at this piece of shit and this piece of shit. Which one's shittier? Well,
this
I mean,
piece
they're both
of shit has slightly more corn in it.
This one would probably sext a client, but you know, whatever. Well, this one would,
whatever. That definitely wouldn't happen, right?
But this one would plant evidence.
Oh my god!
I gotta mention our Valentine's that we made.
Oh yes, go ahead.
So around Valentine's Day, I made making murder Valentine's cards, where one of them was this Officer Colburn, who throughout the narrative of making a murderer, it's implied, and that's part of the defense, is that the evidence against Stephen Avery, including stuff like blood and items and such of like DNA or whatever, to pretty much put him at the scene of the crime and make him look guilty, were planted by Officer Colburn, and I forget the other guy, it's like Lank or something like that.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Who, I think he's an investigator or detective or something.
Yeah.
And so there was a picture of Colburn, and it's like, how much do I love you? Let me plant the evidence. and then I did one. In the first episode, they interview, because there's a big deal in the original case where he went to prison. Stephen Avery went to prison for 18 years. They basically, what is it? It's like they basically just have like deposition from all the people involved in that case.
Yeah.
And now, like, including Colburn and including, like, other police officers, including the police sketch artist. And
sketch artist.
That guy's crazy. And if you ever doubted if he had any, like, if he somehow didn't enjoy the fact that they nailed Stephen Avery, for whatever fucking reason, he frames the sketch he did of Stephen Avery, or the perp in that attempt, that sexual assault from the 80s. Mm-hmm. And he frames it and hangs it in his office.
Yep.
And I made sure to make a Valentine that said, what can I say? I'm drawn to you. Be my Valentine. And I made sure to include the really shitty sketch.
I love that thing. He treats it like it's a fucking Thomas Kincaid portrait, and it's just fucking terrible.
Well, because it's like a stupid trophy for him. It's like,
well, the thing is, like, even then, if it's just a shitty sketch artist, whatever, like a sketch portrait, I don't give a shit. That's fine. That's what he does for his job. But he says things like he trusts that drawing more than he trusts like forensic DNA evidence.
Yeah, because that's what eventually got him exonerated.
Yeah, and he's and it's
evidence that they may have known for like decades or some shit.
Yeah, it's heavily implied that they did, and it's just like, you, sir, are a moron.
Yeah, and it's just like
this show really brought out a side of me that I haven't ever felt, or at least haven't felt in like many, many years. Where I think there was one point where. Was his name Thomas Kratz?
The prosecutor.
Thomas Katz or whatever.
It's like Ken Katz or Ken Kratz.
Yeah, where Kratz is talking about how, like, basically a big portion of the defense for Stephen Avery is talking about how, I keep saying and then pausing, and I know that's not good radio. I know that's not good listening, but. They're talking about how their big part of the defense is that most of the key evidence in the case against Stephen Avery just doesn't seem kosher. Like, it feels planted. And Kratz,
which is ironic,
jumps immediately to them saying, oh, well, you're saying that the cops murdered Teresa Halbach and planted it on Stephen Avery. And like, he just immediately leaps to that conclusion, you know, in order to turn it into like a big slippery slope. And I actually shouted fuck you at the television, and I haven't done that ever. Like, I hated that guy. He was terrible.
You hated him. He was awful.
He was awful. And I love how after the fact, you know, like, well, you know, they left a lot of evidence out of the miniseries because, you know, you can't have a good witch trial story without all that. And it's like, you, sir, are in no position to talk about fucking anything. Because it's revealed at the end. And the thing I love about Kratz as a character, if Kratz was a fictional character, I would say this man cannot exist because no one would be that cartoonishly evil and stupid. It's a lot like how... did you ever see Jarhead?
Oh, it's been a long time.
Okay, but... Jarhead. You remember Jamie Foxx's character, right?
Yes.
Okay, based on a real guy. The real guy that Jamie Foxx plays has a tattoo of a tiger on the back of his head.
Mm-hmm.
They left that out of the film. The filmmakers said, we left it out because if we put that in there, nobody would fucking believe us. Because it's a detail that's just so on the nose that it takes you out. You're like, okay, like you're making your point too hard. Like, I get it. You're losing me. So they left that detail out. If Ken Kratz was a fictional character, and he, like, I would say, like, man, you really did your best to really make, like, it like an unapologetically awful person for this thing. And yet he really exists. And he did all of the things that he did. And then at the very end of the series, when it's revealed that Kratz has been disbarred.
And because he sexually harassed.
Because he sexually, he kept up a, like, he sexually harassed the victim. It was like a client of his, right?
Yeah, it was like someone that he was representing.
He was representing her in a sexual assault case. And this was not the only person he had done this with. He had done this with several other women too.
Mm-hmm.
Like he would send them, like, you know, like horrible like text messages.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, if that had been a fictional character, I would have said, that's okay, you're making your point too strong, okay? Like, I get what you're saying, but come on, you need to lay off. No, he exists, and he really did those things. And so when he's, like, trying to throw shade over on the making a murderer team, it's like, you, sir, are in no position to talk about fucking anything.
Mm-hmm.
Do not even try.
God.
I know, just God, what a sack of shit.
Okay, so the car, finding the car and Colburn knowing the information about the car was the first moment.
Yeah.
What are the other two moments?
Probably the fact that they convicted Brendan Dassey on a completely different story that, like, completely contradicts what they convicted Stephen Avery on. Spoiler alert, they both get convicted.
Yeah, because one of mine would be the coerced confession.
Oh my God, absolutely.
That might be the best episode of the whole series.
That one is in particular feels like a fucking, like,
because you're just watching this kid and you're watching, you know, these guys basically just try and, because, you know, they're trying to basically, so Stephen Avery's nephew Brendan Dassey is brought in for questioning because, you know, he supposedly was around the area and he was reported maybe hearing stuff. Like, it was very, like, you know, it didn't put him at the scene of the crime, but, you know, he might have been a witness or something or know some details.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just keeps escalating from that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the investigators, one of them is named Fassbender, but I don't remember both their names. But they're these two fuckers that look like Mutt and Jeff.
Yeah, they really do.
Like, one dude's like this schlubby bald guy and the other's like this really tall dude.
Looks like he was like a military dad.
Exactly. He looks like what's his face from Avatar.
He looks like he could have been the great Santini.
Yes. But you know, and so they're trying to get some kind, because they don't at this point really have much to go on.
They don't.
And besides the car, you know, and it's pretty evident of that. And so, and they show most of, maybe not most, but a good, very sizable chunk of his deposition and his interview, Brendan Dassey's. And it's like, the kid, I mean, he's borderline mentally disabled. I mean, he's not a smart kid. He's very naive and innocent. And there's even one part where it's like, he asks, like, are we going to be done soon? I need to go back to school to submit a project.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh man. this kid has no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
And like, it's not like he's not telling them anything. You know, it's not like he's reaching into his own mind and telling them stuff. He's not remembering stuff.
Yeah.
What it is that they're basically asking, like, okay, we know that there's blood. Where was the blood from? You know, like all this stuff that they have really no basis on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like what happened to the body? You know, of Teresa Halbach. Like what happened to her? Do you remember blood? And he's like, you could watch Brendan's body language, and you know he's like, he doesn't really know what they want, but he just kind of starts to make up stuff.
Because
he wants to get out of there, and he doesn't know what's going on. Like, he thinks if he tells them what they want to hear, he's free to go.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, he tells them what they want. Whether or not it's true, it's very unlikely that it's true.
Well, it's just like a whole bunch of forensic stuff does not add up with that story.
Well, that's
story.
The thing. The prosecution states that Teresa Halbach was murdered in Stephen Avery's bedroom. He lives in a trailer on the scrapyard. Yet there is no blood anywhere in that bedroom. You know, and like, because it's believed that the cause of death was like she was like her throat was cut or something like that.
Yeah.
Or she was beaten and shot or some shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something I forget exactly what it was, but it was something that would generate a lot of blood splatter.
Yeah.
You know,
With everything that they were accusing them of doing to Teresa Halbach, you would have thought that Teresa Halbach was fucking Rasputin.
Exactly. Because it's like that bedroom should be like an entire season of Forensic Files.
Yeah, that bedroom should blind someone with all the luminol that would go off in there.
Yeah, if they just bring in a black light, it should just be nothing. It should just be like a fucking rave in there.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's like there's no blood.
It would be a source of energy.
Exactly.
Put it that.
Yeah. And because also there's no body. They never find a body. I think they find parts of her.
They find fragments of like a skull and teeth.
Yeah.
And that's and some bones, and that's about it. They're never really able to construct a body.
Yeah, exactly.
And one of the big things there is that they're saying that they just incinerated the body in a bonfire in the back, except those fires never reach a high enough temperature to incinerate a body.
Exactly.
And that's just another thing that's like, man, that just like scientifically, that does not add up.
Yeah. And it's not one of those things where it's like, because I know this has been kind of a point of contention with some people, like that it's biased. And while I admit that it is biased in most places, but I'm still saying,
it is. I mean, like it has a point of view that it's going for.
Yes.
But even then, if you ask the filmmakers, it's the same thing with Sarah Koenig regarding Adnan Syed, which is like, we really don't know. Like, is he guilty or innocent? Like, they're not sure. They're kind of waffling back and forth.
Yeah. Like that's one of the fascinating things about Serial. It's like you go and you kind of waffle with her. You know, especially in season one. And season two, the thing with season two, since it's about Bode Bergdahl, is that it's not about a murder.
Yeah.
It's about why did this guy leave his post and basically get himself kidnapped by the Taliban?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why would he do this? I think the thing with Serial season two is that I think a lot of people had kind of, I think the first season set an unfortunate precedent.
It did.
For season two, because the like Serial's not being posted, not being advertised as like it's a murder mystery every season. It's pretty simple pitch where Sarah Koenig says it's a story told week by week, you know, which obviously is a huge umbrella.
Yeah, it is.
And the first season is about this murder mystery about who killed Haman Lee and is Adnan Syed, who was convicted for the murder, is he innocent or guilty?
Yeah.
And I think to kind of lead into the discussion a little bit about why these are resonating now, I think part of it is that it's almost like there's audience participants or participation, I should say.
Yeah, that's
like
with
Serial, you know, you're learning more and new stuff along with Sarah Koenig.
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of like when she kind of questions something, you kind of question something, or you don't have to. I mean, you don't have to agree with them. I mean, like making murder, I guess you could think, Stephen Avery is a fucking idiot, you know, monster killer or whatever. But I mean, I'm not entirely sure where you would get that from, but.
The thing that's the most frustrating thing about making a murderer is that a lot of people are like, oh, well, I'm like my brother watched it before I did. He kind of spoiled things for me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He's a dick, but no, I love my brother.
Love you, Colin.
Love you, Colin. was that he was saying that, you know, like, oh man, Stephen Avery was framed. Absolutely. Like it was a total horrible job. And then he started reading more and more things about it. Mm-hmm. And including one guy who hosts a blog, who is an actual lawyer, who had said, okay, let's just get this out of the way. Evidence-wise, like, regardless if you didn't know context of anything, evidence-wise, Stephen Avery is guilty as shit.
Yeah.
Like, if you didn't know anything about anything, if you just looked at what they had available, Stephen Avery is guilty as shit on paper. But then as soon as you start digging into, like, all the context of everything and, like, the situation regarding everything, you know, then you start understanding, like, okay, this isn't right. But just on paper, he's guilty as shit.
Exactly. Because, and we haven't mentioned this before, but in between his exoneration and his eventual conviction again, he basically wanted a huge settlement of like 30 some odd million dollars.
$36 million.
Yeah. And it's pretty much implied that, you know, they didn't want to give him this money. They didn't want to pay him
that money.
Yeah, they didn't have the money. They didn't want to pay him that.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty clear that the people involved in the original case, who a lot of them get involved in the second case,
yeah,
just don't like him.
Yeah.
And that's where, like, you kind of get this interesting, like, theme on kind of classism almost.
It is.
You know, how because he's just kind of this podunk country guy in the fields of Wisconsin, like, a lot of people are just like, of course he did it.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing. Like, it's kind of like with Adnan in Serial, it's like, well, he's the ex-boyfriend, of course he did it, or he's Muslim, of course he did it, you know. It's like you get like these weird biases that come with it. And I mean, you know, on paper, if you look at it, it's like, okay, he did it. But if, again, it's the context, that's what's so important about making murders, that it puts it in this context.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, if you knew nothing about his history or any of that, it's like, well, you know, if there's blood and there's keys, whatever. Like, if you were getting this report to you live,
yeah,
as it was happening in 2005, yes. But when you learn stuff like how Colburn and Link weren't supposed to be anywhere near the crime scene, right? They were in a different county. They weren't allowed to, because it's like Kassasaw County or something was the one.
So. Manitowoc County was supposed to have, because of the conflict of interest, they were supposed to have literally nothing to do with the case.
And then you find out that people from that county were involved in the case.
Yeah, and they were the ones who found all of the damning evidence.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you're like, well, like, you can't, I don't know how you can look at it and be like, well, that's just a coincidence. You know, it's kind of like, I don't know. Like, these guys clearly didn't like him.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's very, very suspicious when these guys that, you know, were involved in the original case and knew about information that would exonerate him, but didn't, you know, really use it for almost 10 more years or something. It was like 95 that the original actual, you know, sex offender, you know, attacker of the woman in the 80s actually came out and said he did it.
Yeah.
You know, but, and I think he was convicted for it, but they never released Stephen Avery. And so it's like, okay. So again, yes, it's very much context. It's very much like, okay, you know. So from there, it's like, and it's really funny going on like the Reddit for Making a Murderer and just hearing.
Oh God.
Obviously not every thread is going to be great.
Yeah.
I don't want to promise that, but if you go to some of them, it's really interesting hearing people go back and forth and back and forth and be like, how did this work? What if this worked? I mean, how if it happened like this? It's like the perfect kind of water cooler show.
It really is, yeah.
Because you're just bouncing off theories, and because there is no definitive answer. It's not like the Jinx.
No. The Jinx is basically like, yeah, you only got out because of loopholes.
Yeah, and I think, speaking of loopholes, well, actually, we'll get to that. We'll finish with that. What's your? Did you say your third and final big kind of bomb?
What was my third and big final bomb? You know, I kind of got lost along the way, I'll be honest. Because my first one was the RAV4. The second one was convicting Brendan Dassey on an entirely different story that completely contradicts the one
that involved stuff like sexual, like basically raping her. And it's like, there's this like 16-year-old kid.
Yeah. Well, it's just like, there's no evidence to hold it back.
Yeah. There's no substantial evidence of that.
Yeah. There's not enough. I think probably the biggest bombshell, the third biggest bombshell for me involved like Mike O'Malley and Brendan's original lawyer, the one who was just a horrible person.
Oh yeah.
I think the moment when the guy working for Brendan's lawyer, I believe his name was Mike O'Malley.
Not to be confused with what was it, like Guts?
No, it turns out there are multiple Mike O'Malleys there. Was it like O'Rourke or something? I don't know. But that dude, like when he tried to get Brendan to talk to him about things.
Yeah, the guy with the crazy mustache.
And he just basically laid out a whole bunch of pictures as trying to get him to confess, which is like, that is the direct opposite of what you were supposed to be doing.
What was their whole point in wanting that? Do you remember?
Money, because it was a case that he couldn't win.
So he just wanted to be paid and then lose.
Be paid, and he's basically just a horrible asshole, leech.
Yeah, because the guy with the mustache is like the private investigator.
Yeah, he's the PI.
Yeah, he's a PI
and he takes it on himself to basically get Brendan to confess.
Yeah.
And the thing that was the big bombshell for me was just like seeing that footage of him basically coercing Brendan into signing a confession.
Because he's like, he's like in a classroom and he's like asking Brendan to like draw what she looked like on the bed.
Yeah, exactly.
Because she was supposedly tied up on the bed.
It's horribly leading. And the second thing that made me shout, oh, fuck you, was when that dude comes back for the trial and he's looking at the pictures that he laid out on and he gets really weepy at the sign of like this jacket or something that with a Teresa Halbach hat or something. I don't remember what it was, but it was like this whatever.
Yeah.
And he's just like, I'm sorry. I can't look at that picture and not cry. And I was like, you fucking piece of shit. Oh,
fuck you, you asshole.
So I was like, this is so obviously manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
That was the second time I shouted, oh, fuck you, at the TV. Yeah, this show just brought things out in me, I swear.
Yeah.
There's just... I know that there's been, like, a whole bunch of talk about, like, oh, well, here's the evidence they didn't put in the documentary. And honestly, yeah, there's a reason they didn't put any of it in there.
And it's because of...
Because there's really no way to substantiate any of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just basically a bunch of like hearsay and he said, she said. Like as soon as they can back some of that up, until that point, it is only going to sound like hairdresser gossip to me.
And it's just gonna like drag the show.
It's just gonna drag the shit out. It's like, oh well, you know, they didn't put it in here because it made their case look bad. No, it was because it was garbage. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
it was terrible. Like I know that they had a talk with Dean Strang. Mm-hmm. one of Stephen Avery's lawyers, and one of the pieces of evidence was that they were talking about like, oh, this sex dungeon that Stephen Avery had, which is like, you can't really prove that, you can't. And they were asking him like, why did the people take that out of the documentary? Why didn't they put that in? And Strang had said because it wasn't in the trial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was never in the trial in the to begin with. There was no way it was even there. Like they had nothing to take out because it wasn't there to begin with.
Exactly.
So, and I know there are some people who are like, oh man, he's totally guilty. And it's like, here's the thing that's really frustrating about it. Okay. Even if he did, the defense presented a good enough case to where there is reasonable doubt.
Because that's the thing.
They did not even come close to proving beyond a reasonable doubt.
There's a reason why they say not guilty instead of innocent.
Yeah, because there is no real innocent in the court of law.
Yeah, you're either guilty or you're not guilty.
Yeah.
And if there's any reasonable doubt that Stephen Avery or whomever, the defendant, didn't do it, then you're supposed to say not guilty.
Yeah.
That's the whole rule of being on a jury. Yeah. And the jury part is another thing too. I think that's might be, since you didn't mention it as a bombshell, I'll mention it too, just so it gets mentioned. But you know how you get that one guy, one juror who has to leave because of a family emergency. And then they bring in another person, and how we get some insight from this juror and how there was like two people that just would not, they were so stubborn. They would not change.
Yeah. They didn't. They didn't bother getting people from a different county.
That's also true.
Yeah.
Because in cases like this, you want to get people that are, you almost want to fly people in, really.
You almost want to.
You know, it's like, even like the O.J. Simpson trial, which I think, you have the People versus O.J. Simpson going on right now, which is kind of even tied into this. Granted, it's a dramatization instead of a documentary.
Have you watched any of it?
I haven't, but I've heard decent things.
I've heard decent things because, like, I saw that it was like, oh, from Ryan Murphy, it's like that is the last man that needs to be making the O.J. Simpson case.
I know, but I've heard decent stuff.
So have I. Actually, I hear that he mostly directs rather than writes, and he's not a bad director by any means.
Yeah, I think the biggest criticism I've heard is that there's too much of the Kardashians, like the kids. Like, I saw a clip where was it Robert Kardashian, David Schwimmer, who was one of the lawyers for OJ, like they go to a restaurant and you have like all the kids with them and they all have like a line about like, what are you doing with Uncle Juice, daddy? It's like, oh no, stop.
I'm gonna make a sex tape and marry Kanye West along with three other guys including a basketball player. I'm going to bring great shame to your name, daddy.
Oh, you're dead to me, daughter.
I can never bring myself to hate Kim Kardashian because I talked about this on Facebook. Nobody on here follows me on Facebook, so it's great. I talked about this on Facebook. I was listening to her episode of Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR, why Kim Kardashian is on Wait, Don't Tell Me or anything on NPR, I don't understand. But, you know, I welcome different people being on different things. I don't think there's a monopoly on guests that you can have on NPR. She was talking about this story about how whenever she comes back from doing like something press related or like a modeling shoot or something over in France or anywhere across the world, she'll bring something back for her daughter, North. And she said that any time that she brings something back for North and not something for her husband, Kanye gets genuinely like jealous and upset. And that was such a golden nugget of information that I can never bring myself to hate her completely because she gave me that.
Because she knows.
She knows.
She knows.
So, kudos to you, Kim Kardashian. Also, I don't hate her because there's better things to do in life than hating celebrities that you don't know personally. So, whatever.
You know. Unless if you meet her personally and you hate her, there you go.
Unless they're named Sam Pepper or Soflo Antonio, in which case I hope they die. Anyways. Or Nancy Grace. Nancy Grace is like one of the only people I actually wish was dead.
I'm getting there with Trump.
I know
we've had this conversation. I'm getting there with Trump.
I know. It's just, but with Nancy Grace, actually, this ties into Making a Murderer because she is staunchly against Stephen Avery, which is like, oh, of course you would be.
Of course. I think she's against. Is there a defendant that she's not, like, rabidly against?
No.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like she's so one note. It's like, I mean, granted, like, Casey Anthony's, there's a lot of questions there, too, but it's like her. Stephen Avery, probably Michael Jackson, Scott Peterson. It's like everything, you know.
It's the one recently that she was like staunchly against.
I don't even recall any.
Was it the Duke lacrosse team? She was like so heavily against them, and then when it turns out that they were innocent, like she left that day. She didn't come in.
Or like I'm imagining her like supporting like George Zimmerman or some shit. That's the one.
I don't know, man.
Anyway.
Nancy Grace, I just want her dead. That's it.
She's awful. Anyway.
She contributes nothing at all. Have you ever noticed that, like, I once saw footage of her that was not from her cameras, and man, is her face like a topographical map.
Oh my God.
And that's not me making fun of aging women or anything. It's just like when you look at her on CNN and then you look at her at someplace else. Like, have you ever noticed that on her show on CNN, she's always kind of got like the soft focus thing going on?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they don't want you to.
Yeah, go on.
No, I was just like, yeah, because they don't want you to know that her face looks like a topographical map of Utah.
Yeah, we're just saying she doesn't age gracefully.
God fucking damn it, Taylor.
That I should just end. Mic drop. Leave.
Just end the episode right on there. Just, that's it. I'm out.
Bill Cosby, innocent. Bring it back to Kanye.
Kanye. Anyways, on to making a murderer.
So yeah, shit, what were we talking about? I guess with yeah, so you have People versus O.J. Simpson. I think people are just, I don't know, the people, I think I like to kind of see that the success of that show is a lot like similar to this.
Yeah.
I think people are just fascinated. Like, I guess this is where we'll start talking about why people like it so much. I think, you know, we're in, I don't want to make it super political, but I do think it has a lot to do, like, you know, where this, there's a lot of stuff with police nowadays. In
we're living in some pretty turbulent times right now.
Exactly. And I think, people just kind of gravitate to stories where the cops are really corrupt and shitty.
And so, it sure seems like it, right? Especially nowadays.
And you know, I can understand that, because I mean, it's these systems that are in place to help us.
Yeah.
You know, and then you just kind of see how fucked it is in some places.
Yeah.
You know, like Wisconsin, and you're just like, fuck, man. Like, everything is just wrong. And, you know, it's just, and I think that's the real moral of Making a Murderer. It's not so much did he do it or didn't he do it, it's more here's the criminal justice system, you know, in a microcosm.
Yeah,
you know, and I think, obviously not every single place is like it, but I'm sure it's a lot more widespread than we'd like to believe.
It really comes down to like state and city politics as well.
Yeah, that too.
Because like, you know, Manitowoc County, it's a very small place, and you know, obviously everyone there knows each other's first names pretty much. So like that really is kind of a hindrance on the legal system there.
And it almost makes you wonder, like, well, if it can happen in like Podunk, Wisconsin, surely it could happen in more populated areas.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like I said, these are some pretty turbulent times, and especially here there's a lot of distrust of a lot of the justice system and a whole bunch of other places. One thing that I find interesting about it, like I love that Making a Murderer is starting a conversation about like, well, hey, here are some of the shortcomings of the U.S. justice system.
Mm-hmm.
However, I don't want people to take away from it a sort of like, let's just overhaul the whole thing. It's all terrible. Cause it's like, hi, have you been to other countries?
Oh yeah, no, I don't know.
Like in Italy, have you ever been to an Italian court? It's
no.
A circus. It is. People complain about this court in America. It's like, wait till you go to like Italy. It is awful. Like,
oh,
they
yeah.
don't even need evidence to throw you away in jail.
I have no doubt about that. I think the fact is just that, I mean, that's supposed to be one of the things we excel at, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I think that's where it comes from, where it's like, we're better than this, or we're supposed to be better than this.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's, and that's just kind of a lot of the stuff going on right now. It's
American
general, it's
exceptionalism.
It's like, we should be better than this, you know?
Yeah.
And too many people, I think, accept things the way they are. And it's like, no, we could be better than this, you know?
Yeah.
There's room for improvement.
Yeah, so I want there to be room for improvement. I just don't want people to look at it and say, well, let's just, it's all terrible. Let's overhaul it all.
Well, you just need to have more checks and balances for corrupt cops.
Because I'm worried that, like, some stupid, you know, college kids are going to be like, we don't need statute of limitations or we don't need evidence for things. We know you did it, so we're just going to send you away. Like, I'm worried that's where it's going to go.
Yeah.
We're like,
but I think there are
stupid safe space kids.
Because here's the thing, like, I mean, it's all like kind of a domino effect.
Yeah.
Because when, you know, you have a crime that happens and you're investigating that crime, the cops need to do their job.
Yeah.
and make all get all the evidence. Like, I remember, because Mickey Murderer, I might have said this already. I know I've said it to you personally, but this kind of, it's like I had a drug addiction and I got over it. And then, like, it just kind of, I had a relapse, but instead of some horrible drug, it was true crime documentaries.
Yeah.
Because I watched this shit all the time with my mom, because, like, we would watch everything from the weird, like, Unsolved Mysteries to Forensic Files to American Justice to City Confidential, narrated by the great Paul Winfield. Thank you. And it's just like, I needed it, because it's like, it's just so fascinating to me. And in preparation, and we're going to get through this in just a minute, but because we'll have recommendations too of other things you can listen to. Obviously, if you haven't, I guess this is where I'll probably put the end of the spoiler warning. But if you haven't listened to Serial, I would definitely recommend Serial.
Yeah, like I know that it's this big thing, you know, it's this big cultural phenomenon, and I don't know. I guess some people are like intimidated by it, because I know I was. It's like, really, just listen to the first episode. Like, I was going on my way to have lunch with my mom, 30 minutes away, and I was like, well, you know what, I got some time. Here's the first episode of Serial. Just load that up on Podbay on my phone, and I was like, just give it a see, you know, see what happens. Oh my god! Like, I was at lunch and I hadn't even finished the first episode, and I'm like, well, that was the worst mistake I could have made, because now I'm hooked.
So, that was like me. Like, remember me? Like, I got it. I just started it in around the holidays, which was around the time. I think it was like January, and I just marathoned the shit out of it. I'm like, I can't stop. And like, I started season two, because you have more self control than I do.
I've got other things. Well, I've got like other work that I need to work on.
Yeah.
So and unfortunately for me, like you're an illustrator and whatnot. You can draw while listening or watching to things. I'm an editor. Cannot do that.
Yeah. Like, you can listen to music, but you can't give it your full attention that something like Serial deserves.
Yeah, I can listen to something in the background, but even then, I don't even really like doing that. I like paying attention to things. So yeah, like, I don't consume media anywhere near as much as like other people do, because my line of work does not allow me to do that. Like, I have to constantly focus on what I'm doing. Yeah. Serial, just listen to the first episode. Just give that a listen. You won't stop.
And here's my recommended venue for it is Pandora. It's on Pandora, and what I like about Pandora, and I don't know if you can do this with like other venues for it, but with Pandora you can listen to it in parts. I don't know if you can do that elsewhere, but what's really nice is that if you miss something, you can go back and listen to it. So like say you have like the newest episode, it'll be released and it'll be like 8 to 11 parts that are each about like probably 2 to 5 minutes long. Really? So again, if you miss something, you can go back and listen to it. And it's to the point where I'll just like make lunch in the kitchen and I'll just have it playing on my phone, and I'll be like, da 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 da, making chicken fingers, blah blah blah, you know, murder, whatever, you know, like just absorbing everything.
Yeah.
Because that was my intimidation about it, is that like with you know, documentaries and film and stuff, is that it's like, so I'm consuming it through several senses. You know, through sight and through sound. With Serial, since it's a podcast, it's like, oh man, this is going to be dense, because you know you're kind of worried that it's really dense.
It's so dense,
and you know, but it's like, you know, I listen to it, and again, that's why I like Pandora, because you can go back and if you miss something, you can just kind of skip around. Like if you missed a detail about Adnan Syed's, you know, location or whereabouts, you know, or whatever, you can just go back and listen to it. It's free, so you know, if you have a phone, download the Pandora app. You can just look it up, make a station for Serial, because that's how I listen to it, and I work to it, you know, it's great. And I'll listen to them out of, like, I've probably listened to, you know, I haven't listened to season one through yet, twice, only once.
Yeah,
I listened through it once. With season two, I've probably listened to each episode at least three times.
Jeez.
Because Well, because it's just like, you know, it's really like, dense. Well, it's really dense, and, you know, if obviously I'm not listening to it every day, but
so
it's
many
like,
things going on in each and every frame.
It's so dense. It's so dense. And now it's even tougher because there's 2 weeks between episodes.
Yeah.
They did spoil us with the newest episode where...
It was like two back-to-back, right?
Yeah, it was like Thursday and then Friday, and I'm like, oh, fuck, don't spoil me, Sarah Koenig.
You won't get another one for a month.
Yeah, it's like, oh, fuck. Well, Serial's delayed until June. It's like, oh, no.
Sarah Koenig just hates you. That's it.
And then, like NPR explodes. It's like, no, I'll never know.
Ira Glass lives in a glass house.
Does he cast the first stone?
Yes.
Oh.
How do you think This American Life has been a success for all this time?
That's true. There you go. Conspiracies.
You're welcome.
It is cool, though, because I remember telling you about this, is that since, you know, it's kind of the story that doesn't end, you know, with Serial Season 1, they actually did a couple updates because, you know, Adnan actually had, like, a hearing or something recently.
Yeah, he did.
And I remember telling you that, and you, like, flipped out. You're like, what? This is awesome!
Yeah, funny enough, like, last week I made lunch and then listened to it.
Yeah, and there's like it's like 3 days or something, and they're like 15 minutes each.
Yeah, they're literally like 15 minutes each,
which basically equates to a full episode of Serial.
It does. It really does.
So that's always cool.
Serial.
Yeah, Serial.
I remember when I finished it. My parents asked me, Neil, do you want anything from the store? And I was like, yeah, more cereal. And they were like, okay, well, what kind? And I was like, no, the podcast. And they were like, Neil, get out.
They're like, shut up, Neil.
Yeah.
Move out. No!
I thought I was being funny, but then my parents were like, Neil, do you want to hear about how many hours we were in labor with you? We were giving birth.
No.
No, you don't.
Do you know how much crippling disappointment you've inflicted on this family?
You know how much debt we're in because of you?
Oh, that's getting too real.
Yeah, I know.
Too real, Neil.
I'm noticing for the humor in Sweet Weenie, like all the stuff that we've discussed, it all takes like really dark turns. And I was like, man, what does this say about us?
When my father died, he's like, my real hero. Just kidding, I'd want to be a plastic man because I have a huge dick.
I'm glad you liked that. Thank you.
It's like, oh my God.
You liked that one, didn't you?
I want to like scratch your beard in that one.
Yeah, I know, it was fucking ridiculous. I would put
my finger on your lips and be like, shut up.
It's actually even bigger right now. I need to.
Oh my fucking God! I shouldn't complain because I always make fun of you when you shave because you look like,
so fuck
like
you.
You're five.
I'm just glad you liked that episode. Yeah, no, like of all the stuff that we've discussed, like man, it gets really dark. And part of me is like, oh well, maybe we're finding our comedic voice. And then the other part of me is like, no, Neil, I think you guys just have like unresolvable issues.
Yeah, you're just fucked up, and you're just fucked in the head.
We all are.
I wanted to be a part of that the Sweet Feed episode so bad.
Oh, dude, well, we're gonna make more of them.
Like, as like the one guy who regularly reads comics, since you're talking about superheroes, I want to just be like some like weird spastic fan or some shit.
Did you
or just like pull out some really obscure guy? Like I wanted to be the Duck Man from the X-Men because he's like a duck.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.
Did you watch the outtakes video for that?
Of course I did.
Okay, yeah, I actually think that's the best thing we've done.
Yeah.
Video.
Is that organic?
Yeah, we have another one that we
if you want to know what the fuck we're talking about, go watch Sweet Weenie, link in the description below.
Yeah, please do. I'm just happy that someone's around to talk to about videos that I make.
So now that we've talked about well, you finish what you're gonna say.
Oh no, I was just gonna say we're gonna do more Sweet Feeds, but it's going to be like actual like BuzzFeed videos. Like that was one that I just wanted to do where it's like, you know, such and such reacts to, you know, whatever. Fuck you, fine bros. But there was another one that we were going to do, like, cause Ryan and I were talking, like Ryan, Steven and I were talking about one, where it's like shit best friends say, but it was going to be like horrible things that people say to each other. And Ryan and I remembered, like, oh, yeah, BuzzFeed does make these videos that are, like, live-action sketch videos that are horribly stilted and just awful. And so, yeah, we're going to work on that one.
You should do one where someone draws like parody the like drawn in the style of something.
Oh,
so it's
God.
Like these Disney princes drawn in the style of H.R. Geiger. There you go. I made you laugh. You can have that one.
It's good. We might have to. I'll have to talk with them about it because Ryan likes H.R. Geiger.
Oh my God.
Anyway,
I will draw everything.
Oh my God, that would be funny. Yeah, we'll just think of like horribly disgusting things. Disney princesses reimagined as bathroom cleaning products. I don't know.
Anyway,
toilet rolls found in gas stations. I don't fucking know.
Now that we've talked about Making a Murderer and cereal, which anyways. Again, if you've skipped now and you skipped the spoiler stuff, please watch. Please give it a try. Making a Murderer. We hope you like it. And try out cereal. I still recommend trying it on Pandora because then it's a little easier, kind of get into. And if you miss something, you can go back.
I listen to it on Podbay. Like Podbay is the app that I use on my phone, and Podbay is wonderful. Actually, one they don't give you like a forward or a fast forward or rewind button, but they do give you an option to go back 30 seconds.
Okay,
and you'd be amazed how much of a help that is.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, like if you're like me, listeners, and you're intimidated by it, and you might. Worry that you'll miss something, you know, you'll have a chance either through Podbay or Pandora. You'll have chances to go back and listen to him. So we hope you give that a chance. And now, I'd like to talk, you know, just kind of run down a list of recommendations. So like, let's say you've watched all of Making a Murderer or Serial, you've listened to all of it
and you didn't let the crushing sadness, you know, overtake you.
Yeah, you're not just like in a burrito of a blanket on your bed.
Yeah, because like, I watched Making a Murderer all through like the Christmas break.
Oh my God! And yeah, they released it around Christmas, which is
It was the worst thing I could have done. Like, every time I loaded it up, I think I even posted on Facebook. I was like, "Why am I doing this to myself?" I finished it before Christmas, and I was like, "Man, fuck everything."
Man, merry fucking Christmas!
It was awful.
And then, like, your parents will ask, like, what do you want for Christmas, Neil? I want Stephen Avery to be free.
I want Stephen Avery to get a new trial in a new county. Can you give me that, Mom? Yes, Virginia, they did. They did convict Brenda Dassey on a completely different story that contradicts the one that they convicted Stephen Avery on. Yes, Virginia.
I hope... What do you want for Christmas, Daniel? I just want trust in our criminal justice system again.
All I want for Christmas is Brendan Dassey to get released. Oh, not one of those stupid whitehouse.gov.
I like how this is like after the spoiler thing, like the spoiler warning, and now we're just spoiling shit.
Well, to be fair, this is all stuff you can find on the internet very easily.
I know, whatever.
Yeah, no, like, hopefully no more, like, stupid whitehouse.gov petitions where they're like...
Because Obama can't do anything about it, guys.
Well, because it's gotta be on a state... It was a state ruling. Federal government has no power over that.
You have to write the governor, don't you?
It's like, guys, do you know anything about anything?
No, and we just know what we want.
Has to respond to it after a certain amount of signatures, but even he's like, guys, I appreciate it, but like, we can't do anything. Sorry.
Yeah. So you gotta send it to the governor of Wisconsin, right?
He's probably not even gonna listen because he's probably a sack of shit. I don't know.
We're just gonna fucking assume whatever, you know.
Wisconsin is the worst fucking place ever.
Wow. Yeah, that's where Red Letter Media is. Fuck them.
You know what? They're okay then.
They're the one good thing. And the Packers. I like those two things about Wisconsin.
Packers won the Super Bowl.
I probably shouldn't talk shit because everyone talks shit about Ohio and Cleveland anyway, so whatever. I'd be a hippogriff.
Whatever.
So, Neil, is there any other documentaries that you would recommend people try out if they want, you know?
I'll keep my list brief.
I'll keep it real short because I'm sure people are like, God, I wish these ass clowns would stop talking.
Go back to talking about Sweet Winnie. Okay.
Okay, sure.
Said no one.
No, I wouldn't do that to you guys. I only did that for like 5 minutes. Okay, so obviously watch The Jinx. The Jinx is incredible. It was on HBO. It was the Jinx, the Life and Deaths of Robert Durst. And
is that what the actual title is?
Yeah, okay. That's the full title.
Which again is another example of, like, you know, we talked about like losing faith in the justice system and like how you know, the whole like guilty not guilty thing is very important, and it's important in the Jinx too, because Robert Durst, he's basically the heir to a real estate, you know, empire in New York City.
Skyscraper.
Yep. And, you know, he's been linked to it at the very least 3 murders.
Yeah.
Well, one's a disappearance, but it's believed to be foul play.
Everyone pretty much knows it's a murder.
Yeah. I mean, his wife went missing in the early 80s. And then his neighbor, which is the one that he was actually tried for. And then his friend and confidant was conveniently killed before she was willing to give information to authorities that may incriminate him. So, and now, because I guess this spoils a bit of the Jinx, but whatever. Since it is very new news, during the documentary, they find new evidence that incriminates him. And it's equivalent to like the big mic drop.
It is,
you know, those from Making a Murderer. It's just like, oh fuck.
Yeah, you know? It is, for a show that is actually relatively low key about everything, it is the closest thing the show has to a mic drop. And man, that last scene, like, it's all building up towards that. And man, does it not disappoint.
Oh my God. And you know what's so crazy about, maybe my favorite part, like, normally I'm not big on recreations in documentaries.
The recreations are my favorite thing about that.
They're awesome. They're so gorgeous. Unnerving.
They're gorgeously filmed.
And they're unnerving and creepy and weird. And, like, I love how you never see people's faces.
Yeah, that's the best thing. That's actually something I was going to bring up, is that you never see anyone's faces. It's just, it's vague enough to be creepy.
Yeah.
But they're so, like, stunningly staged and well shot. I think actually one of my favorite shots of all time comes from the Jinx. It's when they're talking about the murder of Durst's best friend and confidant.
Mm-hmm.
It's where, like, you see her, like, just it's like a god's eye pan over of her wood floor, and her dog walks across. And slow, mm-hmm. Like, it's all slow motion. It's like, it's you know, yeah. Her dog walks across, and then, like, as soon as the dog passes, you see that he has bloody footprints.
Oh, it's so good.
And then as the camera keeps panning, you come across the pool of blood, and then you see her body. And it's just like, man, that is how you stage a fucking shot right there.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
Andrew Jarecki, right?
Jarecki. What happened was he wrote and directed a film called All Good Things, which starred Ryan Gosling and Kirsten Dunst, and it was about Robert Durst.
It was it was basically like the names were changed, but it's basically his story.
Yeah, it was Robert Durst and his wife who disappeared, and from what I remember, it is not that great of a movie, but you know, whatever, that's okay.
He got in our good graces with the Jinx.
Yeah,
he can basically just pack it up and do nothing else, because that'll be his magnum opus.
Yeah, that dude could literally do nothing else, and it'd be like, you know what, Andrew Jarecki, you're okay with me. But what happened was, Robert Durst caught on to that story. And, like, he caught on that it was him, and he called him and said, "Hey, I just want, like, I saw your film, and I know that was me. How about I grant you an interview, so I can tell you exactly what happened?" And then that was the basis of the Jinx.
And can I just say that Robert Durst has the blackest fucking
eyes. He has the blackest, deadest eyes, but I'll be damned if that man isn't sort of charming.
Like Dora's eyes, Neil.
Like, I remember I remember Andrew Jarecki was saying, like, he really started to like the guy by the end, and it, like, when they found the new evidence, he almost didn't want it to be true.
Well, he's such a weird, like, I guess, vague, like, charismatic in an odd way. Like, yeah, he's interesting.
He's charismatic in, like, a really unique way.
Like, it's like, I don't even want to say charismatic, he's just interesting. Like, he's very interesting.
Yeah.
You know, like, because it's like, if he did do it, and there's all this stuff, and then you, like, he just has these weird lapses in judgment. Like, it's like, it's like there's times where he's like Hannibal fucking Lecter and how like cunning he is, and then he's like fucking Mr. Magoo the next.
Yeah.
Like where he basically gets caught stealing a sandwich from after supposedly killing a man.
Yeah.
And he's on the run and he steals a sandwich.
Yeah.
And it's like, why did you steal the sandwich? Because I thought I could get away with it. It's like, well, you fucking did, you idiot.
I don't get it. So anyways, The Jinx, highly recommended. And I think really the only thing, I mean, okay, so there's an IFC series called The Staircase, which I have never watched personally, but everyone says like that's like a good precursor to, you know, The Jinx. And
yeah, that's like listed on like everything.
Yeah, which I haven't seen it because it's not really readily available unless you buy the DVD, which I don't really feel like doing. There's a podcast that I listen to called Sword and Scale, which my brother actually turned me on to. And it's a true crime podcast, and I think they're up to like 60 episodes now. But yeah, it just covers like a whole bunch of true crime series or true crime stories. And that's really about as far as I can say. Like, I have some issues with it, but man, I'll be damned if I can't stop listening to it. So,
Sword and Scale, you said it was
Sword
called?
And Scale. Sword and Scale.
Okay, so that could be another recommendation.
That's another recommendation. Sword and Scale, that is referring to Lady Justice, the things that she has in her hands.
Thank you, Neil.
Because that, no, because like, that took me fucking forever to figure out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
just figured it out, and you just mentioned it to me.
It was like when my brother discovered that the target symbol was actually a target. That sort of thing. Like that's exactly what it is.
Oh, call it.
That's exactly what it was for me. Like I had like a eureka moment.
It's like so, yeah, it's like that like Keanu meme.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah.
Oh. Okay, so what else you got? So you got the staircase.
That's about it for me, really. I'm just
gonna... Well, you got me onto Paradise Lost, right? I mean,
yeah, I got you onto Paradise Lost,
which is it started in the 90s. It's this trilogy of movies, and I want to briefly touch upon it because I haven't finished the first movie. I'll be honest, it's a little tough to get through.
It is
just because it's long.
Yeah.
And I'm not used to the style because unlike a lot of these, it's very like fly on a wall in terms of how it presents stuff. It's like you're not watching Talking Heads. And it's, you know, stuff like The Jinx is all about interviews and depositions and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And instead it's just like they're just filming scenes and get togethers of people, you know what I mean? Like there are some Talking Heads and stuff,
mm-hmm.
but it's definitely not as much as you're used to in
yeah.
talk. And so I think to for me that it kind of takes a little out of it for me. But I remember I talked to Casey about it. You know, Geeks at Large member Casey, who had watched all of them too, and he says that as they go, they get more like, you know, traditional stuff.
Well, you have to keep in mind that documentary filmmaking was really different. Before there was like non-linear editing systems.
Yeah.
Cause you couldn't do any like really fancy tricks or anything with it. Like it was much more traditional. You had to be much more careful about it. Like I know there's one that I watched, at least the first half hour called Sherman's March, which was about a guy who was, making a documentary about Sherman's March to the sea in the Civil War. And halfway through halfway through the making of that documentary, his girlfriend breaks up with him. So he starts making a documentary about dealing with the breakup of his girlfriend, except it was made in the 80s. And man, documentary filmmaking was unwatchable back then.
Yeah.
It really, because it's all long takes and you can't do any fast editing. It's just like there's so much dead air a lot of times. It was really when Ken Burns started doing his thing that he really did revolutionize documentaries. He and Errol Morris.
Yeah, because I was going to say, I guess I could lead into the next one, which is The Thin Blue Line.
Yeah.
Which is the godfather, granddaddy of all these kinds of documentaries. Now, I know you had a hard time getting through it.
I think it was because I was just tired.
That could be it. Because I actually watched this today when before we started filming, and it's like that was the first time I had watched it, and it's like it has a lot of the stuff you're talking about in terms of editing, like it's well, like the it has the fast editing,
yeah,
you know, like they do some cool stuff with editing in this, and this is from 88.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that. The ending of it is not unlike the Jinx. That's all I'll say. Yeah.
Well, you watch the Jinx after you watch the Thin Blue Line, and like even just the recreations, are very heavily inspired. Except, I'm gonna go on and say it. I like the recreations in the Jinx more.
Oh well, yeah, sure. But I mean,
well, I don't know if that's like considered heresy in the film circles, but
I don't think so. I mean, there's
just like. It's like, okay, the recreations in the Thin Blue Line are, of course, like revolutionary for their time, and they're really well shot. You know, they're really well shot recreations that don't feel cheesy by any means. But the ones in the Jinx are just art.
Well, it's just a matter of time and tools. Yeah, you know, and there's also the fact that I think the recreations are much more of a thing in the Jinx. Yeah. You know, because it's also longer. Keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. I think I'm pretty sure it is.
Well, the Jinx is a miniseries, and the Thin Blue Line is a film.
Yeah, and the Thin Blue Line is like 100 minutes, which is on Netflix, by the way, listeners. Yes. So if you haven't watched it, it's on Netflix. A lot of these that I'm going to list are on Netflix.
I'll probably give it another shot tomorrow.
Definitely, it's great. I think you know it's really interesting because it's like it's definitely a time capsule. You know, and you watch the people that are being interviewed, and there is a bit of me where it's like, man, these guys feel like characters out of a fucking like fictional movie.
Yeah,
but exactly. They're real people. They're real fucking people, and I don't know. Maybe just people were just more well spoken back then that they could actually talk and not say or whatever every other word. It's definitely filmed differently. Like it's film for starters.
Yeah,
I'm assuming. The Netflix version is like the Blu-ray. It's high def and it's pretty grainy, but I kind of like that. I think it adds to the mood of it.
It's from the
70s or not. The documentary is from the 80s. The crime was committed in the 70s.
Yeah.
So yes, the Thin Blue Line. It's great. Check that out. Central Park 5 is also on Netflix.
Yeah. That's one of the few modern day Ken Burns films.
Yes. Yes, it is. And that's a great one. And basically what that deals with is about these five teenage boys. They're all black, basically being accused of the assault and rape of a female jogger in Central Park in the late 80s. And it's talks about, I think, going back to what we were talking about with, you know, the political climate of law enforcement and stuff like that and the relation with the black community. You know, there are several, like, that's because of how heated and how much of a spotlight that's taken in our society, as it should, you know. We're getting more and more documentaries about that. And I've got at least two to recommend. Well, there was also the one where it was 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets, or if I'm remembering that right, an HBO documentary.
I don't remember. I don't remember that one.
But Central Park 5, it's if you want to kind of if you're at all interested in kind of, you know, the injustice of the law of the justice system and how that relates to, you know, race to the black community, I would definitely check that out. Yeah.
It's a really good one. I caught it on PBS a number of years ago, and man, like I wish Ken Burns did more like modern.
I know it's so good.
It's really like it's really got this like really upsetting atmosphere.
Exactly. Yeah.
That I wish he would do more of. And I mean, it technically has a happy ending, but it's like
it's very bittersweet because it's like you know, spoilers, but you know, the guys get out, the kids. But I mean, it's kind of like Stephen Avery, where it's like they've been unjustly accused.
It's like, you know, how many years of their lives did they lose to it?
Yeah, because I mean, the documentary. I think Central Park 5 was like 2012.
Yeah.
So, and I think the crime took place in like 88 or 89. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's a long. They lost a big chunk of their adult lives.
Yeah.
You know, and now they have to reintegrate, and it's like you listen to the guys talk, and none of them are bad guys. They're all, you know, you know, decent human beings,
yeah.
You know, and it's just, you know, you have the atmosphere of 80s New York City, which yeah. was just like fucked.
Yeah.
You know, and now to correct myself, it was 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets was the documentary I'm talking about. It's okay, on so HBO. It's an HBO film. It's on HBO Go. So if you're an HBO subscriber, or I'm sure if you do HBO Now, which is like, you know, the cheaper alternative where you just have streaming, I'm sure it's there too. Yeah. That's from last year, and it deals with the case, I believe it was in 2012, where it was these unarmed black teenagers were in a car and a man drew a gun on them and shot one of them. Do you remember that? It's in Florida. It was around the time of the Trayvon Martin case.
Okay.
So, and it's just like kind of builds on the whole like, wow, Florida fucking sucks.
Yeah, Florida's awful.
And I haven't finished 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets, but I definitely do like it so far.
Okay.
I like, it's got like this kind of cool jazzy, you know, score. It's like Making a Murderer in that you learn a lot from the family of the kid who died. Cause just one kid died.
Yeah.
But then you see stuff about the guy, the defendant, the guy who, shot the kid. And I don't know if I'm going to waffle or not, cause it's just kind of like, oh, why'd you do this, man? But,
yeah.
Cause it's basically believed that like he claims that he felt threatened because he thought that they had a shotgun or something. Like he had, like the kids had an item, you know, kids were in the car. And one of them had I believe it was the kid who was shot, looked like he had a shotgun or a pipe or some shit or whatever. That's what the defendant claims, and that he acted in self-defense. That's his whole defense case.
Yeah.
Obviously it's not, I didn't shoot him or I wasn't there, obviously, because there's all sorts of eyewitnesses. But that's very fascinating. It's also another race in criminal justice. One last one for that would be the Tales of the Grim Sleeper, which I did recommend to Neil, but he's apprehensive because of the guy who made it.
Grimfield, God.
Which I don't mind him. It's fine. I will say he also did, he did two documentaries about Eileen Wuornos, who was a serial killer who worked as a prostitute in Florida and killed guys. Charlize Theron played her in the movie Monster. It's not like that where I don't think it's as narrative heavy as those movies.
Okay.
Or most of his movies. Like I think it's saved by, you know, the people he talks to. Like he talks to one woman named Pam who is a former prostitute. And she's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Like she's super charismatic and fun. You know, she tells it like it is, man. And it's really cool. And
Super charismatic and fun, which does not describe Nick Broomfield in any way, shape, or form.
Well, there's parts where he actually laughs, and it's kind of funny. Like,
okay.
They're telling him, because he's like this British white dude and in South L.A., which is where the crimes takes place. And Tales of Grim Sleeper is important now because the trial of the guy, I forget what his name is, it escapes me at the moment, but it's going on right now.
Yeah.
So if you want to be caught up on that, watch the Tales of the Grim Sleeper about this guy who basically, you know, killed women. It's not even sure. It's kind of like the Green River Killer, where they're not quite sure how many he actually killed.
Yeah.
But it's a lot. And they were all, you know, prostitutes. There are all these women that, you know, were prostitutes. And it's this, again, it's kind of putting a light on race in criminal justice and how, you know, the law enforcement didn't take the necessary precautions. Like they didn't warn people that there was a serial killer on the loose. And if they did, you know, probably most of these women would have been, you know, saved and still alive.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. And that stuff's fascinating. And so that's on HBO Go. As is, 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets. Two more, Cropsey, which I think you told me about first.
Yeah. Cropsey initially starts off as kind of like, okay, whatever. Because I think it's like trying to do like the boogeyman. He exists. Like, okay, whatever, fine. I don't care. But then it starts turning into like a whole like wrongful lawsuit thing, or like mm-hmm. like, you know, like reasonable doubt case. Yeah. And that's when it becomes really interesting.
Because what's the case basically about? It takes place on Staten Island.
You know, you've seen it more recently than I have. So,
well, it's basically that I think between the late '60s and the mid to late 80s or something like that, you know, all these children disappeared, and there was kind of this urban legend on, because it's framed by that. It's framed by like kids on Staten Island were kind of had this urban legend about a boogeyman that kidnapped kids on Staten Island. And this all ties into that that mental institution. I forget what its name escapes me. Geraldo Rivera did expose on it way back in the 70s, and it's fucked up. Like,
yes,
that's like where it becomes kind of like this horror documentary. You're just like, fuck this.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Yeah.
And how one of the former tenants, I think, or maybe worked there, and it's like, it's just as much a murder investigation as it is like a history of this kind of dark underground of Staten Island.
Mm-hmm.
Like how there's like this, there was like these communities of like these mentally, you know, unhinged individuals that kind of lived in the sewers and stuff like that. And it's very, you know, unsettling stuff. And, you know, just, it's pretty fascinating. It's a pretty well done documentary.
Yeah, it is. Like I was liking it, but I wasn't thrilled with it. But then like when it starts form, like taking shape into what it's going to become, I liked it a lot more.
Yeah. Cause it starts kind of as like, it's almost like it changes its state of being. It goes from like kind of this gaseous mass that you don't really know what it is when you first started. And then it kind of becomes like more and more solid, you know, it changes its state of matter.
Yeah, exactly.
As you know. And it's great. And, any other things you want to say about Cropsey?
It's good. Watch it.
It's good. Watch it. It's also on Netflix.
And your last one is?
Finally, let's end it with probably the best one of the bunch, which is Into the Abyss, which you've watched.
I have.
It is directed by the legendary Werner Herzog. Can you give us a hint of what he might sound like, Neil?
He might sound a little bit like this.
Can you say, that's a bingo?
Ah, yes. That's a bingo.
When Neil and I were in college together, that was one of my favorite things you did was Werner Herzog. Werner Herzog, like, he's kind of, if you took, what's his name, Nick Broomfield or whatever, Broomfield, and made him a little more charismatic in German, and... there's a great like genuineness to Werner Herzog, and there's a very like modesty to Into the Abyss. Like, here's a guy who's made some of these like really crazy ambitious movies, and then here he kind of makes this very kind of low key, very personal documentary following these two guys. One of them's on death row, and that's kind of the main thesis of the documentary, which is about capital punishment. And obviously, kind of like, you know, Making a Murderer has a point of view, which is Werner Herzog is against capital punishment. And it's interesting, you know, I mean, he's German or Austrian. He's from that he's from Europe, and I'm not sure what their I don't know exactly what their stances on capital punishment is in, like, the country he's from. But I'm sure he's probably against it. You know, he's a very humanist kind of guy.
Yeah.
And very interesting. Like, he interviews, like, I forget the name of the kid, the one who is on death row, but they actually interview him like 8 days before he dies. And he dies during the production of the movie. And they actually talk to the daughter of the woman that he killed. And, I think he also killed her brother. And you know, you get her reaction. So it's like, you get kind of, you basically like one case and the different people tied to it from both the defendant's end and the prosecution victim's end. You've got, you know, obviously the criminals who did it. You've got the victim, the victim's families. You even have the wife of one of the guys. That's a whole interesting angle. And they talk about just kind of capital punishment. And, you know, you said that your favorite part is the beginning, which does, which isn't to say that it peaks early, but...
It's just a scene that just you just remember. It starts off with, is he like the warden of the prison, or is he like the guy who's responsible for the executions?
That's the guy who is actually like one of the guards that takes care of the execution. That's later in the movie.
Okay, yeah.
I'm not sure what the guy's title is, but I know the scene you're talking about. It's the first scene, and they're in the cemetery where all the death row inmates are eventually buried if they're not accepted by family members.
Yeah, and it's in two parts. The first scene is him just trying to... you can tell that he's in interview mode.
Yeah.
And like he's trying to be like kind of... He's like putting on a show, you know, trying to be very like diplomatic about what he's talking about. And it's just interesting because like you have that part and like I said, you can tell that he's definitely putting on a show. And then it cuts and then it comes back to him and it's the exact same position, but his manner is completely different. It's almost like he's just been completely disarmed. Like he's not putting on a show at any point, and he's talking about death. And it's really like a really sobering conversation with him. Because like when you're talking to like the first thing that they talk with him about, I don't remember what he was talking about because like I said, it's been years since I've seen it. But it was just such okay, this is nice to hear you talk about this, but like I don't really give a shit. Like this is just kind of like it's a fluff answer.
Right.
And it's kind of annoying how much of a fluff answer it is. It's like, Werner Herzog, why would you start off your documentary like this? And then you get in like the immediate satisfaction of having him like actually talk about death. And it's really a subject that he very clearly holds dear, and it's something that he thinks about all the time because he's around it so much. And like I think he even like kind of breaks down and cries at one point, and it's like, man, the stunning difference between those two scenes.
Yeah, he doesn't break down and cry, but he does, like, you can kind of tell that his voice is breaking a bit.
Yeah, that's it.
Like, it's getting very personal, and because he's very religious, the guy they're talking to. Like, they talk about, you know, and most people are very religious because it takes place in Texas. Like, the guy on death row is like, well, you know, I'll go home, either I'm going home or I'm going home, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's just very haunting. Like it's very strange and impactful when you view this guy and who did horrible things and how, you know, you see him living and then you just know that he's dead by the time you finish the movie in terms of the chronological order of things.
Yeah.
And to me, that's like really fascinating. They actually talk about his execution. They don't, you know, show his body or anything weird like that. No. This isn't like the opening of Paradise Lost where you see the bodies of dead boys and it's like, oh God, this is buckle up, kids.
Buckle up, motherfuckers.
But you, again, like I mentioned earlier, is that you hear, cause you know, the daughter of the woman he killed and I think the sister of the brother, you know, her brother also got killed too. Yeah. And she kind of describes what happened and how like, you know, they tie him down. You actually learn some of the process of lethal injections, and I think my favorite part of the movie is when they talk to the guy you mentioned to him. He's the guy that was kind of in charge of kind of restraining the prisoner and, you know, overseeing the execution process, and just how it affects him, you know, like he eventually just kind of quit. He stepped down from his post, and he had a pretty comfy job, like, you know, and he stepped down because he just couldn't take it anymore. And here's this guy, like, and you first look at him, he looks like kind of your stereotypical Texan guy. He's like big and burly, and he's got a very Southern drawl. And
not unlike a Sam Elliott mother fellow.
Well, he's bigger than him.
Yeah.
It's like if you mix Sam Elliott with Porkins.
Yeah, exactly.
And just, you know, you see how it affects you, him, and it's like, here's a guy that, like, if you just looked at him, you think he'd be, like, one of those really big, you know, right-wing guys who are like, you know, capital punishment is great, because that's usually how, you know, kind of the stereotype is that right-wing people are for capital punishment, left-wing people are against it. And again, this is Texas. But it's just like when – it's like you never – just a perspective that, you know, when you've actually witnessed someone dying – you know, that affects you. Cause you know, we have, cause like you and me, we, you know, and hopefully most people out there have not witnessed that, you know, but it's like when you do witness it, it affects you, yeah. You know? And I think a lot of these people, like, you know, with capital punishment, their tunes might change if they are actually part of that process.
Yeah.
So, and I do love how like kind of organized Into the Abyss is. It's like a video essay. You know, you got like the little Roman numerals. So
exactly, yeah, it's really worth looking at. I mean, like it's basically, you know, a Werner Herzog true crime documentary, but like, man, it's about so much more than that.
Exactly. It's a Cropsey in that way, where it starts with like a very like, you know, single idea. You think you're just, because originally I think it was supposed to be. Like a mini series, and it was supposed to be a film that focused on multiple cases.
Yeah.
But then I think they did eventually air like the other cases in like a mini series on like Investigation Discovery of all places. Cause I think they co-financed the movie.
Yeah. Good on you, Investigation Discovery. If you're ever at my house, which you're probably never going to be, not you, I'm just talking to listeners. our house is almost always on Investigation Discovery.
Investigation.
And also, if you ever want to, if you're ever, like, speaking of Werner Herzog and Into the Abyss, this is not true crime related, it's just something interesting. Werner Herzog made a 30-minute short documentary about texting and driving for AT&T.
Oh my god.
And it's called From One Second to the Next, and it's about people who have died in text messaging accidents.
Damn.
So if you're, it's on YouTube, you can find it.
It's probably it's probably fucking awesome.
Yeah. So, if you're ever interested, go ahead and check it out.
Like, I'm pretty sure Werner Herzog could make a fucking documentary about eggs.
I'd watch the process of making eggs.
Or how, like, what goes into making an egg McMuffin. Like, here, can you start that documentary?
Here we see the eggs being mass produced. They scrape from their bowls on the assembly line as we all humans go into this life. Watch as they are plucked from the assembly line and placed.
I'm losing it. I can't do Herzog anymore. It's turning into like this weird, like, Brazilian accent. I need to stop.
Can you just have him tell us to watch Fitzcarraldo?
You must go and watch Fitzcarraldo.
Do it, kids. It's a good movie.
Watch Fitzcarraldo, kids.
All right.
And then go watch Burden of Dreams.
Oh, my God.
And then go watch the all cardboard recreation of Burden of Dreams. It's pretty great, kids.
All right. So I guess that wraps it up.
At the end, I feel like Rick from Rick and Morty. I just need more.
Tiny Rick.
Go watch Fitzcarraldo, kids.
Morty, go watch Fitzcarraldo.
Yeah.
Okay, Rick.
Oh, jeez, Rick. I don't know.
Oh, jeez, Rick. I got this book report to do. Oh, watch it on Netflix, Morty. All right. Well, I think that about does it for this episode of Geeks at Large. Thank you for joining me, Neil.
Absolutely. It was always a pleasure, and it's true crime documentaries is something I always feel very strongly about, or something I'm very passionate about. Thanks for letting me come on board and talk about Stephen Avery and shit.
Yep, and as we said earlier in the podcast, be sure to check out the links below. We got a link to Sweet Weenie's YouTube channel. We'll have a link to the trailer for Neil's documentary that he worked on, Geriatric, and our audio commentaries. And
tell you what, I am also going to send you the link to From One Moment to the Next.
Oh my god, okay, I guess that will be in the...
That will be there.
We're gonna have like this fucking laundry list. Like,
well,
never let it be said that we don't, you know, we don't try to look out for
it'd be like, did you see Spotlight? Did you see Spotlight?
Oh yeah, dude, of course.
It's like the end of Spotlight with all the cities. or better yet, the Red Letter Media joke in their newest review. Did you see it?
Yeah.
Where it's like where it's like Benny Hill music. Yeah. Okay, so that's gonna be what the links are gonna be like below us. But
funny enough, speaking of like Spotlight and everything, Spotlight is probably my second favorite movie of the year.
Which I guess is also a true crime film. I mean, it's about...
It is. It's more of a journalist. It's more of a...
It's a journalist thing, like, you know. I mean, it's still a crime
like
that happened.
Like President's Men.
Yeah.
It's a lot like that. I would say it's more in spirit to that than to say, like, The Staircase or The Thin Blue Line. But, like, I was talking with people about Star Wars. And, like, mm-hmm. Star Wars, you know, Force Awakens is good and all. But I think it really shows something about filmmaking nowadays where the ending of Spotlight, which is like for all the special, like all the crazy special effects in Star Wars and Transformers and all that stuff, nothing in that movie, in those movies, nothing in those summer blockbuster movies aside from Mad Max made my jaw drop any more than the list of all the cities at the very end of Spotlight where sexual abuse cases had been discovered, and it is yep. just a laundry list. And like, as soon as like you think it's like, oh, it's just gonna be like, it's gonna be a small list, it is like three or four columns.
Mm-hmm.
And like that made my jaw drop more than anything in Star Wars. And really it all comes down to good storytelling. Like special effects are great and all, but if you're not telling a solid story, you know, blah. But that's what I've been telling people, like, you know, like the biggest jaw dropping moment for me, excluding Mad Max, was, you know, the list at the end of Spotlight.
Yeah.
Like, that just had such an impact. But, you know,
Watch
Spotlight, kids, if you haven't seen it.
All right.
Watch Mark Ruffalo yell at things.
Yes. Which is always great.
I will.
you always want Mark Ruffalo to yell at stuff.
And if he's got a Boston accent, then more power to you.
Yes. So, thank you again, dear listeners, for sticking around this long. God dang.
How long did this one end up being?
About 2 hours.
Oh, my God. We said we weren't going to do it.
We keep trying to get out, and they keep dragging us back in.
Thank you, Al Pacino.
quick, we gotta get a Jaws reference back in. Dora's eyes.
Thank you. Thank you, Quinn.
I love doing Quinn's tall side thing. Anyway, we thank you for listening. And until next time, Neil, I, and Werner Herzog will remain at large.
I am not a criminal.